With us on the Tuesday edition of It's Your Turn. I was looking at the calendar today. October 17th, 2 weeks from today, is the last day of October. Two weeks from today is Halloween. Hard to believe, huh? Wow. And you know, I just want to warn you, it goes crazy after that, because you got Halloween. Right after that, you have Election Day. A couple of days later, it's Veterans Day. 2 weeks after that, it's Thanksgiving. And, you know, it's just helter-skelter. We're that close to the holiday season. We have a good program lined up for you today, we think. We have several guests. We're going to be talking a little bit later on the program with Joel Fuhrman, Dr. Joel Fuhrman. He's a medical doctor. It's actually, it's the second time, I think, we've had Joel Fuhrman on with us. You see him on TV quite a bit. He's had four of those PBS specials, you know, when they do like health specials on Channel 13. We want to talk about his latest book. It's called Fast Food Genocide. And that's pretty strong words, but he's a firm believer that fast food is killing us, American society. And he talks about what to do about it as well. So that'll be coming up a little bit later on the program. I think we have some other stuff for you as well. But first of all, we're very pleased to have a couple of guests with us here in the studio, including a gentleman from the Butler area who's become a pretty good acquaintance of mine, and that's my friend Joe Rendick. Joe, always good to see you.
Hi, Dave.
Always good to see you.
Thanks for having us on today.
And also with us is a gentleman that I met a year ago, but it's nice to have him back. That's Tom Grant. Tom, good to see you again.
Thank you. Happy anniversary. And thanks for having us back.
Sure.
Appreciate it.
We are coming up shortly on the on what's known as World Polio Day. What is it? I think it's next week. Is that right, Joe? 24th, whenever
yes.
that is.
October 24th. Mm-hmm.
What's that all about, Joe Rendick? What's World Polio Day about?
That's a day that Rotary International has set aside to refocus on their efforts to eradicate polio through awareness and fundraising.
I was looking at my calendar there. I'm sorry I got you confused. It's a week from today. It's next Tuesday.
Yes. Yes.
I don't know. I'm still getting used to the fact that we're into the second half of October already. I can't believe it. Rotary International, Rotarians around the world, have been battling to eradicate polio for some years.
Yes, over 20 years, I believe.
Yeah.
Yes.
And they've
1985.
Done a pretty good job. Yeah. It pretty much wiped it out, all except a few countries. And I think there are some political tension problems there that have really handicapped them.
Yeah, it doesn't help at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are three countries, yeah.
Is it three countries,
Three
Tom?
Countries, Afghanistan and Pakistan and Nigeria.
Ah.
Yeah. Nigeria had been polio-free, actually, for a year. And they had a few cases back. Yeah.
Now, and this may not be your area of expertise. It certainly isn't mine. Is this because their societies are adverse to injections or something like that? They don't want people to get shots. You have any idea? Or maybe it's religious objections. I have no idea.
Now, there were a few cases of that in Nigeria some time ago. There was some problem with that, but that got straightened out by some moderate religious leaders of Islam. But if you think of Afghanistan and Pakistan in particular, they're very mountainous regions where it's very difficult to reach people.
Uh-huh.
And there has been some resistance by some of the terrorist groups in Pakistan. They killed a number of volunteers a year or so ago.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, my
yeah,
goodness.
Dozens of them. And the volunteers just kept coming back. It's amazing.
Wow. These were volunteers who were trying to give
nurses,
polio vaccine to people.
Nurses, doctors, yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
The terrorist group came in and shot them. Yeah.
Wow. Mm-hmm. So World Polio Day marks the anniversary of the Rotary's attempt to wipe it out. Is that the deal? Call attention to the fact that they're almost there, but they're not quite there?
Yeah. Yeah, I think it is an anniversary day.
Yeah, I think it's also Dr. Salk's birthday. I think
it'd be a good day to select then.
Good to choice, yeah. Yes.
Listeners, both our guests, Joe Rendick and Tom Grant, are polio survivors. Joe, you had polio as a very young child, right?
Yes, in 1952.
You were what, five, six?
5 years old.
5 years old?
Yes.
Tom, what about you?
I had it in 53. I was 17.
Oh, you were, so you were much older.
Yeah, I was, yeah. It's unusual. Most of the people get polio, I believe, are under the age of five,
mm-hmm.
or a large portion of them, yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's what we usually hear of. Although, you know, when you think about, and I'm no expert on the history of polio, I know a little bit about it, one of our presidents had polio, and that was Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Right.
And he was an adult, wasn't he, when he contracted polio?
27, I think he was. Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
He was well into adulthood.
Yeah, yes.
Of course, you know, I never rely on a movie, but I was watching a bioepic of FDR.
Yeah.
And he was already, well, he held a lot of offices. I don't know whether he was governor of New York yet, but he had been Secretary of the Navy,
right.
or
yeah.
he had a bunch of these different positions. He was governor of New York.
He was, and his Secretary of the Navy, like was it cousin Teddy was?
Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah. I guess I remembered a little bit of that movie. But they did depict when he suddenly became weak, legs became weak, and they diagnosed that he had polio.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was almost 30 years old.
Yeah. And, he was going to go back into politics, and his mother said no, he didn't want to. She didn't want him to do that, not be good for him.
Yeah.
But that's one time where he did not agree with his mother.
Yeah. It says something about, I search for the right word. It's not a stigma. FDR hid the fact that he was physically handicapped.
Yeah.
He was first elected president in the 1930s. And of course, he was...
Yeah,
re-elected three times, four times election.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But he, even though, and I think he had a pretty severe physical disability, did
both,
he not?
Yes. Both legs.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Both legs.
He had braces on both legs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he was always, when he was giving speeches, he would be either at a podium where he could kind of hang on to it.
Yeah.
Sometimes you'd see him with a person next to him, kind of supporting him,
yeah.
And of course he did the famous fireside chats,
yes,
where he was sitting down. So,
yeah.
And even in the, if you look at the war pictures, you know, when he's with the Stalin and Churchill and, you know, all the bigwigs of the Allies, because they would get together at Yalta and these other conferences, always sitting down.
Yeah. Yeah, that the news media cooperated with him quite extensively. They didn't usually show pictures of him walking with his crutches. There was sort of an unspoken agreement there.
It wasn't just polio. That's why I didn't.
Yeah.
I was trying to think of the right word to use. JFK, John F. Kennedy, had severe back problems, and I can't think of the disease that he had. It started with an A.
Addison's, I think. Addison's disease?
Tom, am I glad you're here today.
Thank you.
Man, you're
Thank
like
you.
You're like my personal Google.
Do I win a prize?
I could have sat here till next Tuesday, and I wouldn't have thought of that.
I was a history teacher. That's, let me admit that.
I knew it started with an A.
Yeah.
And that's a fairly serious disease.
Yeah, yeah.
Some people thought, he strained his back, mm-hmm. or... He got hurt in the war, PT-109
yeah.
or something. But
yeah.
this was a serious ailment. Nobody knew about it.
Yeah, right.
Hidden from the public.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you're right. The news media cooperated with that, didn't they?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So,
yes.
Kind of amazing why we would think that our leaders, simply because they had a condition, would not be fit to be president.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It wasn't just our culture, you know. Did either of you see the film 3 or 4 years ago called The King's Speech?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
About the, I want to make sure I get the right, it was the English king who took over when his brother abdicated, but he had a severe stammer.
Yeah.
And he had been a stutterer since childhood.
Yes.
And there was great concern because this was when Hitler was firing up, you know, his crowd over there with these demagogue speeches and mm-hmm. so on and so forth, and they didn't want the King of England to go on the radio and stammer.
Yeah.
And it's a wonderful story, by the way.
Yeah.
It's a great movie.
Yeah.
And true, true. Well, anyway,
I'm
getting off on a tangent here, but...
I think it shows them to be more human when they show the difficulties they have, you know?
I think it's absolutely true.
Yeah.
And, hey... Most of us have these of one sort or another, some mm-hmm. more severe than others.
Yeah.
Nobody's perfect. Nobody's. It's like using the the models that they use in clothing ads and so on. You know, and adults, I think, realize that these are all airbrushed and artificial. Kids don't.
Right.
So if a kid's a little heavy or whatever, their nose is a little crooked, they get all bent out of shape. Hopefully we can get past that.
Okay. They are starting to show some more people with disabilities in advertising.
Mm-hmm.
I've noticed over the last few years.
I've noticed that too. Yeah. Even people who are wheelchair bound, I've seen.
Yeah.
And I've seen, and this is very refreshing to me, photographs of like when a high school is doing the musical and a cast member may be physically disabled, but hey, they're still doing the musical. Yeah. I think that's great.
Yeah.
That's great. Did either one of you experience glances like that, whenever, especially when you were a kid? Now, you developed polio. You were only 5 years old, John.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't really remember any of that type of thing when I was a kid.
Did you, I mean, I know for, because I know your story somewhat, you went to school at the Watson Hospital for a while, didn't you?
Yeah, I was in the D.T. Watson home, mm-hmm. yeah, for almost 2 years.
But eventually you started attending public school here in Butler, right?
Yeah, yes, I did, yeah.
No problems with other kids?
Not really. I guess maybe I was lucky.
Well, maybe you had some sensitive classmates, huh?
Yeah, maybe it was the nuns.
Yeah, that's true.
Kept everybody.
Yeah, you went to Catholic elementary school?
Yes.
What about you, Tom? Now, you developed polio later in life.
Yeah, I never did have that. I got stares. I guess I'm more conscious of them now, but mostly I'm kids, mm-hmm. mostly looking at the crutches, mm-hmm. wondering what they're about. But when I was in school, I didn't have that problem. I was a senior. I was on the football team and all that stuff, so everybody knew me. I didn't get that. Mm-hmm. I did get out of class 10 minutes early every time. That was good.
Yeah. Were there kids or maybe parents who were afraid that their kids were going to catch something from you?
Not that I know of, no. Mm-hmm. I think I was more oblivious at that mm-hmm. time to things, mm-hmm. but no. It was just something that people accepted, I think, like other diseases that people in my generation got.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Polio was not mm-hmm. spread by coughing anyway.
Yeah.
Water contamination for the most part.
There was thought that it was contagious. I had a sign up outside that no one could come into the house.
Really?
Quarantine. Thank you, John. Thank you.
Really?
Yeah. Yes. But my friend snuck in anyway. Huh. Yeah.
Did you have to miss, I'm sure you missed some of your schooling.
It was about 2 weeks into school, I think, and I came back before Thanksgiving. I was back in school again. With the leg brace and crutches.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that was a much shorter time than for Joe.
Yeah, I was lucky that way, yeah.
Did you say you were a couple of years at D.T. Watson?
Almost 2 years,
yeah,
yes.
Boy.
It's amazing to me when I hear, and I'm not, I realize there are people, good-intentioned people, and there are people very passionate about their concerns about vaccines. And most of the physicians and medical researchers that I've talked to say that mm-hmm. it's, you know, the fears are groundless. It shouldn't be there. But everyone always points to polio. They say, look at where would we be without the Jonas Salk vaccine, the polio vaccine?
Yeah. I was talking to a school nurse a few weeks ago, and we'll talk about the conference later. Joe will speak about that. But I spoke to a school nurse, and she has a problem once in a while with parents who don't want their child to get the inoculations. And sometimes religious, but mostly it's a kind of a personal philosophy. Mm-hmm. And that always disturbs me very much, because the only way to eliminate any disease is if everyone is immune from it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I've talked to some parents, and like I say, I won't denigrate them. I know they're passionate about it. I'm no expert, but from everybody that I've talked to in the medical field, they say, you know, some of the things that they used to put in vaccines are not there anymore, and that vaccines are perfectly safe. So,
right. There was a major study done a while ago, which was got a lot of publicity, where the fellow propositioned that children got autism from the mm-hmm. vaccines, and that study was totally refuted. And the fellow finally admitted that he falsified the results. Mm-hmm. And so I've not seen any rational reason given why people should not have their children immunized. It protects our own child, first of all.
That the autism factor seems to be the big thing among those parents who have these concerns.
Yeah.
And admittedly, it's a small minority, but you know, I always say, well, there were autism cases before, before the sock vaccine, for one thing.
Yeah.
This all happened. Well, I know it was in the 50s. It was in the mid-50s, right, that Jonas Salk announced, I've got a vaccine against polio, and it works.
I think it was 1955.
Joe,
you know the story, Tom? He was kind of participated in the trials, right?
Told me that.
Through the D.T. Watson home.
No, but you had already contracted polio, right?
Yes. Yeah. But my parents and my brothers and sisters, they were also, everyone was involved in the testing.
Oh, so they all got the test shots too.
This was actually after the vaccine had been approved. It was a controlled follow-up type group that we they went back once a year and had blood work done to see if the antibody was maintained in the their body.
Mm-hmm.
And that went on for several years.
And of course it was, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
As far as I know, it's pretty much the same, the vaccine that Jonas Salk developed, pretty much the same one we use today, right?
It is, yes.
It obviously worked. It's very effective. Mm-hmm. There was an oral vaccine that was developed later.
Yeah.
I can't remember the doctor's first name. It was Sabin was his last name.
Right.
I don't know whether they still have that or
that's
not.
That's the one that's used for the programs around the world, but the drops.
Mm-hmm.
But that's because it's much easier to use, and it's about 60 cents for a dose. The Salk vaccine is much more expensive. It involves a needle.
Oh, that's right. You need a syringe.
Yeah, so, but,
a sterile syringe.
But Joe and I were talking before the program that the problem with the Sabin vaccine, the oral vaccine that's used, is that it's a weakened virus. The Salk vaccine, the virus is killed. The Sabin vaccine, the virus is weakened. And there are cases right now in Pakistan and Syria where the virus can be passed on, and it mutates in body, in the system, and it can be passed on. Up to this point, there have been 56 cases of that in the world this year. So far,
that whole concept, and again, I don't have any medical training, but we just did a news story. In fact, this morning I did a story with a physician from Butler Memorial Hospital, Dr. Elliot Smith. Some people are concerned that if they get a flu shot, they'll get the flu, or some people maintain that well, I got one of those stupid shots a couple of years ago, and I got the flu. And Dr. Smith was explaining, we had some sound bites from him, that it's not a live virus. The vaccine that they use for the flu shots is not a live virus. You cannot, it's impossible to get the flu from the shot. Now, he did say that if you were exposed, sometimes it takes a couple of weeks for a flu to develop, if you were exposed before you got the shot, that's probably why you got a shot and came down with the flu, but it's physically impossible to get it from the shot. So I didn't realize the difference between the two vaccines.
Yeah, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sabin is a weakened but alive vaccine.
Yes.
Salk.
It
was just a story.
Yeah.
Sometimes the coincidences in life just amaze me, because I was talking with Joe, or we were emailing, I don't know, a few weeks back to see if we could, you know, arrange to chat in advance of World Polio Day. And it was within a couple of days, this is from the Sunday Pittsburgh Press a couple of weeks ago, that it was actually an obituary for the former editor of the Pittsburgh Press, John Trone. Pittsburgh Press, of course, long gone now. That paper died after a long strike. But some of the people that worked there went on to work at the Post-Gazette. They had a nice obituary, and then they had a picture. John Trone with Dr. Jonas Salk in 1956, and he always considered that, the late John Trone, one of the highlights of his journalistic career, that he covered Jonas Salk and the announcement of the vaccine.
Saw that.
For people who weren't alive then or who were very, very small back then, it's difficult for them to understand what a scourge polio was and what fear that struck into the hearts of parents, especially in the summertime, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Swimming pools, theaters, stadiums. Yeah.
Back in the day, and there were mothers who just, they were nervous wreck during the summertime. Is that when you contracted polio, Joe? Do you know?
I got it in September, about 2 weeks after I had started first grade. So and it takes it's like a two-week incubation period, so I probably got it around the end of August.
Right at the tail end of the summer. And you said you were at the beginning of the school year.
Beginning of school year, 2 days before our first football game. And I went to school because I was aching. My legs were aching when I went to school, and it got worse during the day. And so I finally went to the doctor, school doctor, and he gave me an aspirin, which I threw away and was told later that was the best thing I could have done. Uh-huh. And so I went home, and that night I tried to walk, and I fell down. So the next morning, my family called the doctor, and he came over and gave a cursory examination, really, and he said I had polio. I never went to the hospital. I was very, very fortunate that way. I was at home the whole time.
We have some things we want to talk about here today, but a general discussion of polio I think is appropriate because we have one, two, three generations now who have no memory of this being such a fear. Ever since the mid-50s and the Salk vaccine, you haven't had to worry about it here in this country anymore. They worried about how it was spread. They worried about their children coming down with it. Mostly it was children who contracted polio, not always.
Same time I had it, it was a 10-year-old girl who got polio, too.
You were ready to start another football season.
Ready to go. Last full practice before we had a Friday night game. This was Wednesday. Yeah, so it's tough.
Wow.
Tough for my team.
What about your families? I know, Joe, when you... did you go to the Pittsburgh Hospital? Is that where you were diagnosed? Because I know your house, your family's house was quarantined, right? It was sealed off.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I was diagnosed in Butler and sent to Municipal Hospital in Pittsburgh, where I was in isolation for about a month. And the house was put in isolation. Yeah.
So they had a sign. You were a little kid, but I'm sure you're. Parents told you about it. They had a sign on the door.
On the doors.
Polio case, stay out.
Yeah.
My dad and my oldest brother pretty much moved out for that time period. Yes. And
did you have any younger siblings?
Yes, I did. Yeah.
Would they have to stay inside the house too?
They probably did. At that time, Mary Phillips was working with the March of Dimes. And she... work with my parents, to bring, brought food to the house and helped them get through that time.
The late Mary Halton Phillips, we never cease to learn about the humanitarian work of that woman. Much later, of course, founded the Maradon Museum, but we're talking about the same person.
Yes.
I also heard, I think it was her, who was involved in getting funding for... those kids who whose chest muscles were paralyzed and they couldn't breathe, and they needed those big devices, those big contraptions to breathe.
Yeah, that would have been bulbar polio.
Yeah. What's come again?
Bulbar polio.
I see. That's something, again, because we don't deal with it anymore in this country. I don't think there are no cases of polio at all in the United States anymore. Yeah. People don't realize there were different kinds. And some people were much more severely affected than others, right, Joe? I think you told me that some time ago.
Yes. Yeah, everyone is completely different. It could have been a mild, very mild case. Could have been a severe case. And the more milder cases are now, 30 years later, they're experiencing post-polio syndrome, which is a condition where their muscle, their foot, their ankle is deteriorating, and from years of having walked on it and used it in a normal fashion.
Mm-hmm.
So now they're starting to have a lot of trouble, you know, throughout their whole system from the original polio virus.
So they did not experience any paralysis when they originally got polio?
Perhaps not, or very little. Just they were able to get by, you know, without bracing.
But now some effects showing up later in life, huh?
Yes.
Yeah.
What about, have either of you gentlemen experienced any of this? What's it called again, Joe?
Post-polio syndrome.
Post-polio syndrome?
Yes, I was diagnosed in 2001 with it. That was 48 years, was it, after my polio? Yeah.
Is there...
It's still there.
Is there treatment or...
Therapy. Therapy helps out sometimes. There isn't much they can do, really, to treat polio. They really don't know what to do about it.
Even all these years later.
Huh? Stretching exercises, which is what I'm going through now. Mm-hmm. I had a fall last week. 2 months ago, I had a fall. And I'm getting therapy now for it.
Well, at least they didn't give you an aspirin, Tom.
No.
I can only imagine if we had, we have cable news coverage today. We have 24-hour TV coverage, all sorts of social media. Can you imagine what it would be like if today it was Jonas Salk announcing? Because he had a press conference, I think it was in Pittsburgh, right? I've developed a polio vaccine, and it works. It wasn't just that he developed it. He had this press conference announced that it works. Yeah. It works. I mean, that would have been a story for weeks.
Yeah, it would be like announcing a cure for cancer today, probably.
Very good analogy.
Yeah,
today.
Yeah.
And we'd have been all over the news. Wow. I want to talk about a couple of things that have happened recently. There was a conference, Joe Randig, that you were telling me about that I know you were involved in.
Was involved in it, and Tom was involved in it. Mm-hmm. It was the Pennsylvania Polio Survivors Network put on a video conference. Several locations in the state, and our location was Cranberry Library. And we had we were able to contact about over 50 polio survivors in the area to create awareness for the conference. We had a doctor and a college professor presented a half hour program, and then they took questions and answers.
No, this would have been like simulcast to all the other locations around the state where people were gathered. Pretty worthwhile, pretty successful. Were you there, Tom?
I was there. It was very successful, much more successful than I thought. Yes, 50 some people came, was it?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. And I know from my perspective as a polio survivor, it opened my eyes a little bit. You know, you think you have it bad, but then you go to an event like that and you realize you don't have it so bad. You see the guy who has no shoes, you know, people in wheelchairs, people in scooters, several people I saw on crutches. I had no idea how they could walk, but they did. Mm. Polio survivors are an extremely stubborn group of people, and they just keep going.
You have to be.
Yeah. You just can't give up. Yeah.
Are there plans to do this again? Because this was the first one, wasn't it?
Yeah. The first one on this, the largest scale. They're thinking about doing it every other year.
Was the rationale mainly to raise awareness of this post-polio syndrome thing that some people are starting to experience? Or?
Yes, and also raise awareness for the Pennsylvania Polio Survivors Network, which is an online group of polio survivors, and it contains a lot of information on post-polio rehabilitation, and it's a great source for anybody who has any questions or interest in polio or post-polio.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. One of the good things about social media, huh? Able to hook up online with people that are in the same position as you are.
And there were a number of non-polio survivors there, too. There were some Rotarians there who just helped out, assisted people coming in. And I talked to some of those, and their eyes were opened to actually what it was, you know, the scope.
Got to hand it to Rotarians. When they come up with a project, it's not some, you know, dinky little thing.
Right.
Let's eradicate polio in the entire world.
Yeah.
And then they go out and do it.
Yeah.
It's really phenomenal.
Yeah. Started with the UN, the World Health Organization, and our Center for Disease Control in the States. And Rotary came in because at that time we were part of the United Nations, but I guess because we had this international network of clubs, they thought it would be very useful. But, yeah, we've taken it on.
That conference was this summer, wasn't it, Jeff?
Yes, it was in August.
So you were in Cranberry. There were several other locations around the state where it was going on at the same time?
Yeah, the other two were near Philadelphia.
Okay.
And then they also offered it on the Internet.
Oh.
Yes, so we had well over 200 participants.
All together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Good stuff. We have to take a break. I want to talk about something else. It's called the Shelter Box Project. And Tom has some information he wants to share with you about that. You're listening to the It's Your Turn program here on WISR. Nice to have you with us on the program today. We'll take a quick break and then be back to talk more with our guests in just a moment here on It's Your Turn on WISR.
Hi, this is Howie Pinckney with Pinckney Capital Management in Portersville. Today, many people need help managing their investments. The investment options available today can be confusing. If you would like to talk to someone for help, why not call me for an appointment? Howie Pinckney at Pinckney Capital Management, 1284 Perry Highway, Portersville, Pennsylvania. My telephone number is 724-368-4224. Securities and advisory services offered through Commonwealth Financial Network. Member FINRA, SIPC, a registered investment advisor.
Welcome back, friends. Nice to have you with us on the program today, the Tuesday edition of It's Your Turn. I'm Dave Malarkey. Our guests are two with us here in the studio, Tom Grant and Joe Rendig. They are both polio survivors. Joe is from Butler. Tom is from Zielinopo.
I thought
I remembered that correctly. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
The old coconut isn't quite
there. Still there. Still there.
Tom mentioned something interesting during the break there that I never even thought about. Today's doctors, younger generation of doctors, maybe a couple of younger generation of doctors, never had to deal with polio.
Right. Yeah.
So as a result, they don't know a whole lot about it.
Yeah. Huh? I've had, unfortunately, a lot of experience with doctors. Emergency room doctors. I had some major surgery done in a major hospital 6 years ago, and I would ask those doctors, what do you know about polio? And one said, well, it's still around, but it's not in the United States. And we have to be very careful about anesthesia, because polio survivors are very sensitive to anesthesia, because the polio has affected our spinal system. Our neurological system is fragile, and we don't need the full dose of anesthesia. So I talked to the anesthesiologist before my heart surgery. I said, what do you know about polio? He said, I think there was a chapter in my book about that.
Wow.
I didn't have the guts to say, did you read the chapter? But as a result of the anesthesia, I spent 9 days in a coma because he gave me the wrong anesthesia.
Goodness.
Yeah.
So that's the thing you never think about. I never thought about
it. Yeah, I wouldn't either, except my wife does wonderful research and found out about it. Yeah.
Well, in terms of, learning the symptoms, okay, I can understand why you wouldn't spend too much time on that in medical school anymore.
Yeah, right.
But goodness gracious, what a red flag for people who've had polio with regard to anesthesia for any of a variety of medical procedures.
Right. Yeah. Yes.
Even dental work, I suppose.
Right.
You don't need as much, huh?
Yeah, the one doctor said, "Oh, that's all anecdotal. It's not scientific studies. It's all anecdotal."
You put up your hand and said, "I'm sorry. Maybe anecdotal for you, but it's not anecdotal for me."
Right. Yeah.
So you obviously recovered.
I did.
Scary though.
It was.
For your family.
Yeah.
9 days in a coma.
Yeah, it was more scary for my wife because I was in a coma. I didn't know what was going on.
My. Okay, medical schools. Bone up on the the after effects for
Let me say, I had no problem with Butler Hospital. Doctors there were very sensitive to that. Okay.
Thanks, Tom. That's good to, good to mention. So the Shelter Box project, Tom Grant, what the heck is that all about?
Well, Shelter Box is something I've been involved in. It'll be 6 years, November 1st. It's a disaster relief organization. It's a partner project of Rotary International because a Rotary Club in Cornwall, England, actually started the program back in 2000. One of their members had an idea for doing that. He had seen something on the news of a relief operation where the truck pulled up to the people who were waiting for food, and the men opened up the back of the truck and just threw the food out into the crowd, and that was it. And this guy said, no matter what we do, we have to treat people with dignity. That's been a major part of what we do. But we try to provide people with shelter. The basis for the whole program was the idea of what the people need when they've lost everything in a disaster. And from that evolved a shelter box, and now we have a shelter kit. The shelter box has a tent, all kinds of household goods so people can, in effect, set up a household for their family. And we use that a lot. The shelter kit allows people to repair their homes. That's what we're giving out a lot of in the Caribbean now. Because people have had their roofs blown off, part of their wall knocked down, and they can take these two large tarpaulins and cover those areas until they can get things together and rebuild their house.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is the shelter box large?
It's about, about 18 by 18 by about 3 feet. Hmm. It's amazing what goes in there. A double wall tent goes in, and cookware, stove, blankets.
Oh, my.
Water filter. Yeah,
and how do you fund the preparation of these boxes?
Well, we do it all through donations. We don't get any money from Rotary. They support us morally and spiritually, I guess, but they don't give us any money. Mm-hmm. So we have to go out and raise the money from private donors, and now we're getting a lot more money from corporate sponsors as they find out about what we do. And I'm an ambassador for Shelter Box, and I go around to all kinds of groups, principally Rotary groups, but I go to churches, community groups. I had a booth set up at the Horse Trading Days in Zillianople this past weekend, and I go all over the place, all over Western Pennsylvania, talking about Shelter Box and trying to raise funds, making people aware of it.
So. When did this program start, do you know, Tom?
It started in the year 2000. In Cornwall, England. We're an international organization. We actually now have affiliates in 20 countries. Started in Cornwall. At some point, a Rotary Club in Florida got a hold of the idea and set up a headquarters in the United States. And it's in 18 other countries now, Singapore, New Zealand, Australia. So.
Cornwall, England is one of those places on my bucket list. I'd love to go. It's like, it's Land's End, right?
Yes.
In fact, the very tip of the Cornwall Peninsula is called Land's End.
We have a group of people called response team members. They're the folks who actually go over to the disaster originally. That's where they get their final 9-day training.
Mm. It's can be rough territory. They
That's
just
what I understand.
Tropical storm Ophelia just hit them pretty hard yesterday.
Right. Yeah.
It's also extremely picturesque. And this is going to be a little bit confusing. Jean Le Carré, the spy novelist, that's a pen name, by the way. His real name is David Cornwell. Not Cornwall, Cornwell.
Okay.
But he lives in Cornwall. There was a month and a half ago, huge story on him on 60 Minutes. He very rarely gives interviews. He gave a long half-hour interview. Yeah, nobody has. At his home on the Cornwall. And, he goes out into his back. That's where I get my inspiration. His backyard looks out on the Atlantic Ocean.
Oh, my gosh.
There's nothing between there and North America, anyway. Cornwall is where it started.
Mm-hmm.
How can people help around here? I'm sure there's a lot of listeners who are hearing about this for the first time.
They can look us up on the internet, shelterboxusa.org.
Mm-hmm.
You can go to our website, and there's a very convenient button there you can push. It says donate if you want to. You can go there to find out more about us, as you've done, or you can go there and make a donation. We're a 501c3 charity, And if you're familiar with Charity Navigator, which rates charities, we get a 4-star rating on that, and on that, which is what the Rotary Foundation gets. And under
that
transparency,
means,
I'm sorry.
Among other things, listeners, that means an extremely low percentage of administration costs.
More than 80% goes directly to our program,
Some charities, unfortunately,
yeah.
take a lot of your donation and call it administrative costs.
Yeah.
So that's a good rating.
Yes.
That's a very good rating.
Yeah.
Okay. Have the supplies been depleted a bit by the recent natural disasters?
They have been. We have, in the world, we have 180 volunteers total. Red Cross has 14,000. We have 180. And we worked very hard in the Caribbean. And by the time the hurricane moved up north to Puerto Rico, and by the time it cleared Puerto Rico, we didn't have any volunteers left. We'd actually put two people in Puerto Rico before the hurricane so we could make an assessment after the hurricane was over. But by that time, we were exhausted. Yeah, more than people power and supplies.
It was a double whammy. First, the Leeward Islands, and it was the first hurricane that skipped Puerto Rico.
Mm.
I get it mixed up, though. Sometimes it was Irma.
It
caused some other damage in the Virgin Islands.
Mm-hmm.
But then Maria came by and just devastated Puerto Rico.
Yeah. Wow. When the first one came through and hit Texas so hard and Florida, we were in Houston. And what we did in Houston and another city, we put, it was called Shelter in a Shelter. We put small tents in these huge places where they were hoarding or storing people, and the small tents. And we gave them to like expectant mothers, parents with children, old people, and we gave them those tents, and they could stay in those tents. And it gives people a sense of privacy in the midst of all that chaos there. And we gave other tents. There was one tent dedicated to mothers who were breastfeeding. There was a tent for counseling, an AA program. There were tents we gave to medical personnel to carry out examinations of people who were there. And so that worked out very well in Texas. Yeah.
And you do all this with 180 volunteers worldwide?
Yeah. Well, we had our president and everybody out working on that one. She was there in Texas helping to deliver those tents. Yeah. It's a great organization. So someone said we're a small dog with a big bark.
Mm.
Yeah. So
they may need some help in Cornwall after Ophelia.
I'm sure they will. Yeah. Because we're actually in 10 countries right now. We're working with Syrian refugees. We're working now in Bangladesh, and they have 500,000 refugees coming in from Myanmar.
Mm-hmm.
We're trying to help them out as best we can. So,
well, they do have natural disasters there. I think they call their hurricanes typhoons over there, a different name.
Yes.
But again, with the evidence of climate change. Who ever heard of Ireland and the United Kingdom getting hit with a hurricane, for goodness sake?
Yes.
Happened yesterday.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Well, half of our the disasters we go to are floods.
Mm.
Yeah. The other half, then half of our responses are to refugees. There are about 90 million refugees in the world now, and we help out a bit with that.
Flooding was the big problem with Harvey in Houston. It wasn't so much strong winds.
Yeah.
It was water. Were you familiar with this whole shelter box program, Joe? I wasn't.
That's how I first came in contact with Tom. I saw him on local television talking about the shelter box program, and I contacted him then. But that's how we first came to know each other.
How can people help again if they're hearing about it for the first time, Tom?
Shelterbox USA. Go to our
online
.org, and when you get to our homepage, there's a button there to donate, and everything's tax deductible.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
good work.
Thank you.
Good work. World Polio Day is a week from today, October 24th. I suppose 50 years after Jonas Salk, it doesn't get the coverage that it would have a little bit closer to when polio was still a scourge here in this country.
No, you don't hear much about it.
Yeah.
No.
Probably won't be any national news coverage.
No.
Probably not.
Yeah.
Oh, is that you?
Probably not.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we'll talk about it here.
Yeah. Good to you. Thank you.
Still important. And for those who have memories of this time, it would be very poignant. Yeah. You know, you two gentlemen have personal memories of it, of course, but there are others who can probably remember what it was like during those summers, those hot summers in the 40s and the 50s. Mm-hmm. Polio, which I think was originally called...
Poliomyelitis.
Or infantile. I'll tell you what, he's my Alexa. He's my my instant Google man here, Tom Grant. I pause for a minute, and he's finishing my sentences. That's very good, Tom.
Thank you very much. Thanks.
Poliomyelitis, yeah. No wonder they shortened the name, huh?
Yeah.
Well, thank you, gentlemen, for stopping in today. Have we covered all the bases, Joe? I kind of sometimes, you know how Irish people are. We just start yapping, and the next thing you know, it's an hour later. Have we covered everything we needed to cover here?
Pretty much we did. I just wanted to mention anybody who would want to make a contribution to the World Polio Day can do that by contacting any Rotarians that they happen to know, or they can also do that through the Pennsylvania Polio Survivors website, and that's www.papolionetwork.org. And they can we can make a donation through that website to the World Polio Day.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, unfortunately for you two guys, Jonas Salk's research came to fruition just a little bit too late.
Yes.
Huh? Yeah, you must ponder that every once in a while, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Joe met him, you know.
I know, yeah. It's
Jonas Salk.
Yeah, that's great. Yes.
He told me that one time, and I don't know. I must have looked askance, like, you know, maybe, oh, yeah, right, John. You met Jonas Salk. Next time I saw him, he shows me a picture.
Yeah, okay. Well, don't doubt Joe.
Jonas Salk giving you an inoculation, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I've also met his son, Peter, who is very much like him. Yeah. Very much like him. Mm. Yes.
Yeah. You know, I saw him quoted in a story. We had an anniversary maybe a couple of years ago. 56 was when he announced that he had a polio vaccine that worked. Yes. So it would have been last year. It was an anniversary. And I saw his son, Peter, quoted. And there were some other researchers, of course. It wasn't just Jonas Salk working by himself in a lab in a corner of the Cathedral of Learning somewhere. Yeah. There were others involved, too.
Right.
And, of course, Sabin a few years later. Mm-hmm. I actually had both of the vaccines. I don't know whether that was common or whether it was just I'm going to make doubly sure or whatever. But I can remember when I was in, I think it was in high school, everybody trooped into the cafeteria and we got the Sabin vaccine. You know, they put a few drops on a sugar cube is what, at least that's the way I took it.
Someone told me this past week that Pittsburgh was the last city to use the Sabin vaccine, the last one to adopt it.
Mm. Well, what do you say? What? I would have got a polio shot. It was like, years ago. Yeah. I was a little kid. Mm. But I don't know. Who knows what they were doing back then? It didn't hurt anything, obviously.
Yeah.
Except you had to eat a sugar cube. Joe Randig and Tom Grant with us today. Gentlemen, I hope to talk again. It's always a pleasure to
talk to you.
Thank
you very much. Yeah. Hope to see you again, Dave. Yeah. Thank you.
And thanks for enlightening us, Tom, on the Shelter Box Project, something that until I got the email from you gentlemen, I was not familiar with whatsoever.
Well, thanks for giving me the opportunity. I really appreciated that.
I'm sure there's a lot of listeners who, same way, said, well, that's a pretty good deal. And Joe, as always, thanks. Good to see you.
Thank you, Dave, for having us on today.
We'll take another break. We have more to come on the It's Your Turn program. Joel Furman joins us next, Dr. Joel Furman. He's a medical doctor. You may have seen him. He's been on TV a lot, including a whole series of those specials on PBS. You know, they do those hour-long, sometimes hour-and-a-half things on public broadcasting. He is a big proponent of eating nutritionally and not eating bad stuff, like processed foods, white bread, and that sort of thing. In fact, he's written a book. It's just out this week, I believe, called Fast Food Genocide. So that's pretty, I don't know, pretty almost an inflammatory title. I'll ask him about that when we talk to him here. By telephone, he's not in Butler, but he'll be joining us here in just a couple of minutes on It's Your Turn on WISR. Stick around. More to come here on the Tuesday edition. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
For more than 130 years, the name Concordia has meant quality care. Today, Concordia Visiting Nurses has provided high-quality, skilled nursing and a variety of therapy services to people in and around our community. Concordia Visiting Nurses is here to foster your recovery right in your own home. If you're in need of home health care, choose Concordia Visiting Nurses. Call toll-free at 1-877-352-6200.
Looking for a way to make your company's benefit package a little more competitive? Here's one that's so easy, more than 130 local organizations and businesses have added it to their programs. Membership in Armco Credit Union. At Armco Credit Union, your employees will have access to the best loan rates and more free banking services, while direct deposit and payroll deduction options make it convenient for both of you. And best of all, it doesn't cost you a thing. Learn more at armcocu.com or by calling 284-2020. Armco Credit Union is an equal opportunity lender and is insured by NCUA.
Going to be talking about fast food, folks, and why it is not good for you. And we welcome Dr. Joel Furman, MD, to speak with us here on the It's Your Turn program today. If you're just joining us, that's fine. My name is Dave Malarkey. Dr. Furman joins us by telephone today. We want to talk about his latest book. The title is Fast Food Genocide: How Processed Food is Killing Us and What We Can Do About It. Dr. Furman, we've talked in the past. It was several years ago, but it's nice to have you back with us, sir.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me back.
So, boy, that's a pretty strong title there, Dr. Furman. Fast Food Genocide. That's not an exaggeration?
You know, I mean, that's the whole point here, is that people have no idea what's going on. I mean, I think a lot of people recognize that junk food, candy, processed foods, and fast foods create obesity, diabetes, heart attacks, and cancer. I think they have an idea of that. But I think the concept of how fast food destructive to the brain, causing mental illness and strokes before the age of 45, putting people in nursing homes, and of course, the link between candy and fast food and mental illness and crime and drug use, we don't really see how destructive it is to whole parts of our society, and especially vulnerable areas of our society, and people living in urban, what they call food deserts, who don't have access to produce and are living on mostly fast food. But fast food has now become, and we're talking here about, you know, candy and chips and cookies and donuts and crackers and rice cakes and breakfast bars and all kinds of junk food people eat besides just what they buy in fast food restaurants. We're talking about this is now the major source of calories in America, and we're seeing a dramatic increase not just in the waistline, but also in mental illness and drug use. And now the majority of people incarcerated in federal prisons today are there because nonviolent rated drug use offenses. And the link between candy and fast food and crime and drug use is stronger than poverty and drug use, is stronger than lack of parents or bad parenting and drug use, is stronger than almost any other parameter we can look at. I'm saying here that fast food impairs thinking skills and it impairs intelligence, and it makes you a food addict, unable to break out of the hunger for calories and for junk food, and it derails people's opportunity to realize the American dream. So this is something that's destructive to our society, and we can talk more about how it affects our genes and destroys future generations' health when we eat fast food ourselves, but the point is that the science that's been coming out on the subject in the last decade, that people have to know this information, and we have to change things in America.
Well, let's define terms before we get too deep into some of the things that you've just mentioned here. The title of your book is Fast Food Genocide. What exactly do we mean by fast food? Is that strictly burgers and fries? I mean, couldn't a so-called fast food establishment serve something that was healthy just as quickly?
Exactly. And so, yes, right, the definition of fast food, of course, in this context means things that can be purchased fast, eaten fast without preparation, absorbed into the bloodstream very rapidly because of how fast the calories are absorbed into the bloodstream. That huge load coming in at one time affects the brain and causes addiction. And, of course, synthetic ingredients, you know, highly flavored. We're talking about foods that are processed foods. We're considering fast foods, junk food, candy, things in bags like chips and donuts and cookies. Mm-hmm. But also, when we eat fried foods like fried chicken and french fries, things that are cooked in oil in a fast food establishment, the cooking of the oil and reheating of that oil causes carcinogenic changes, rancid compounds to be formed. And this food now becomes carcinogenic and mutagenic, means it destroys, it can cause birth defects in our children when we eat it. And the link between just even moderate use of fried foods like that can cause cancer. Like we're talking here, the studies show that one serving of french fries per week of commercial fast food french fries increases risk of breast cancer by 26%. So, yes, we're talking about things that are barbecued and fried on the grill. And so we're talking about processed meats and fast food meats. We're talking about, so in other words, it's the food preparation methods, it's the injection of sugar and salt in the food, it's the use of synthetic ingredients, it's the rapid concentrations entering the bloodstream, it's the lack of phytochemicals, antioxidants, and fibers that are so that the brain needs a continual supply of to achieve normalcy. So it's so many factors coming together. And yes, so a fast food restaurant can serve a healthy bean chili and with a great tomato sauce. So fast food restaurants can change and serve foods that are healthier, too. So this is not an indictment against everything that a fast food restaurant serves. It's against the concept of fast food and processed foods now becoming the majority of the calories Americans are eating and the outcomes and the effect on society that's occurring as a result of that.
So that's rather a sobering statistic there, that just how much fast food Americans are eating these days. Is this a relatively recent development, within the past decade or so?
I don't know about it. I don't really sure the answer to that question. I think that, you know, since World War II, when we've started inventing Spam and Twinkies and Tang and instant coffee, we see the government and scientists invented food for the battlefield so that that wouldn't have to be refrigerated and keep fresh. Mm-hmm. And people ate, you know, these concentrated foods. And then, obviously, when people were driven out of the South with the white supremacy movement and a lot of violence in the South in the early 1900s. And pellagra was a big cause of violence in the South because it causes homicidal and suicidal behavior because of niacin deficiency in the corn-based diet there. After we didn't really discover the cause of that until the 1920s. So there's a lot of factors involved in American history with the growth of the fast food movement and the movement of black Americans into inner cities in the North with lack of food availability and lack of convenience food and fast food became the primary source of calories, which then had an effect to keep these people somewhat oppressed. And their opportunities for advancement were hindered, not just because of social negativity and the lack of an economic opportunity, but also what I'm saying here, the lack of food opportunity and food distribution was and of course, so we made these foods, these new convenience foods and frankenfoods, we made them inexpensive and ubiquitously available, and we made produce more expensive. And some laws in this country supported those foods being cheap and supported produce being more expensive. And then we have this cycle today now where fast food have permeated much of all of society. And sure, it's been worse in the last 20 years, but this process of Americans becoming more obese and Americans becoming more diabetic and diabetes incidence being linked to crime incidence, it's sugar causing sugar consumption and sugar availability and sweeteners and fast foods accelerating drug use and crime, that's been really, worsened since the 1960s and 70s to the point where now it's really become epidemic.
You mentioned a couple of moments ago processed meats. I know the World Health Organization has declared processed meats a class 1 carcinogen. Can you expand on that a little bit for our listeners? Processed meats, what exactly does that mean? What's a processed meat?
Well, I think the processed meats they're referring to are things like bologna, salami, bacon, you know, things that come, big meats that are like processed with nitrates. But, you know, when you barbecue meat or when you grill meat, it's the hot, or a flame broil, whatever you do there, whatever they do in the fast food restaurants, it does cause carcinogenic changes that are accelerated through the production of heterocyclic amines and N-nitrosamine compounds. So we're talking about, it's not the same thing as making a soup and putting some little pieces of shrimp or turkey in the soup was cooked with a water base. So it's not called making a stew or something with some animal products in it or something. It's not the same thing as these high-temperature, fast-cooking methods which darken or crisp the outside of the surface, which increases the carcinogenic potential of these animal products. So, yeah, the World Health Organization is declared meat processed meats, and also fast food and barbecue meats are class 1 carcinogen, the same as asbestos and cigarette smoke. Mm. So we're talking here about the synergistic effect of the high glycemic carbohydrates, the sugary foods, the high salt diet, the low fiber diet, the highest synthetic ingredients and chemicals in the foods, the fact that the way the food is cooked by deep frying it or grilling it or barbecuing it, all these things come together to damage our body, to increase the risk of cancer, to damage our brain, and also I'm saying something new here that's also showing it damages our genes, so it makes our children and our grandchildren more predisposed to illness when we eat poorly. So we're not just destroying our own life, we're weakening our genes, and we're passing on weaker genes to future generations, causing a more preponderance and a more predisposition to more early life disease and early life strokes and early life and autism and learning disabilities and allergies and other problems are passed on to our offspring. And the issue here is that these urban populations eating processed foods and fast foods suffering with 10 times the risk of heart attacks and 7 times the risk of stroke before the age 45. Mm. It's exacerbating racism and bigotry now because people's lack of ability to succeed health-wise or intellectually or into their careers are being blamed on their skin color and not on their food exposure. You follow me?
Yeah. All right. Listeners, we have to take a quick break. We have a few more minutes that we're able to chat with Dr. Joel Fuhrman here on the program today. And by the way, if you're thinking, have I heard that name before? You probably have. Dr. Fuhrman has been on lots of TV shows, Today Show, Good Morning America, Dr. Oz. He's had several very successful specials on PBS, and he's also written a number of other books, too. We're talking today about fast food genocide, how processed food is killing us and what we can do about it. It's the latest from Dr. Joel Fuhrman. When we come back in just a moment or so, we'll talk about the second part of that title, What Can We Do About It? You're listening to It's Your Turn on WISR, back right after these words. They are booking already for the holiday trips, the many, many holiday trips that are available through Butler Motor Tours, a local company. They're on South Monroe Street in Butler. They've been taking folks from around here to places near and far for, well, now going on 77 years. Their website, we'll give it to you in a moment. All of their trips are listed there, by the way. It's a wonderful website. The dates, the itinerary, the cost, everything else. It's butlerbus.com. Butlerbus.com. And yes, lots of trips for the holidays. Here's just a couple of ideas you might want to think about. Ogle Bay Festival of Lights. It's down in West Virginia. A lot of folks not interested in driving the whole way down there, and especially driving back, right? Well, why not go with Butler Motor Tours? They're taking two trips down there. One is around the Thanksgiving weekend, another one a week or so into December. Ogilvie Festival of Lights. You visit the Carriage House Glass Museum and some other stuff, too. How about New York City for a one-day shopping trip? How in the heck did they do that? Well, you leave here in western Pennsylvania late night on a Friday. You can sleep or snooze on the bus. You get to New York City early Saturday morning, a full day of shopping, back on the bus at 10 o'clock, and next thing you know, you're back home again. December 2nd is the date for that, a one-day shopping trip to New York City. Here's one for the kids. Santa Express on the Titusville Railroad, a great family outing. All aboard. Lots of stuff there. Sing-alongs, carolers, and, of course, Santa Claus. Country Christmas traditions and the overly Christmas lights. Ever heard about this? It's in Ligonier. It's nice. December 13th for that one. They're also taking their one-day trip again to the annual Pennsylvania Farm Show. January 7th is the date in 2018. You can get the details on that from the website. Butler Motor Tours online at butlerbus.com. butlerbus.com.
Whether you're a competitive athlete or a weekend warrior, any injury that keeps you on the sidelines is not one worth having. The sports medicine specialist at Tri-Rivers Musculoskeletal Centers will help you get back into action so you can keep up your lifestyle. Our experts understand that the same treatments for competitive athletes can be used for those who just want to be able to stay active. They accept major insurance plans, including both Highmark and UPMC. Learn more about how you can get back on the field by visiting TriRiversMSK.com.
Welcome back, listeners, on the It's Your Turn program here on WISR. My name is Dave Malarkey. Our guest visiting with us by telephone is Dr. Joel Fuhrman, M.D., author of his latest book, Fast Food Genocide, How Processed Food is Killing Us and What We Can Do About It. So if we shy away from all of these things that you mentioned earlier in our conversation, boy, that's a lot of stuff that we're eating. What do we shift to? What's healthy to eat, Dr. Fuhrman?
Well, you know, I'm a very strong advocate that people have salads, that have people eat raw vegetables, because there's more than 200 studies and a meta-analysis showing the link between raw vegetable consumption and lower rates of cancer and longer lifespan. So one of my mantras to tell people is to eat a big salad every day as a main dish at least once a day, and put in lettuce and cruciferous vegetables and peppers and tomatoes and onions. The scallion and onion family, very powerful, it protects against cancer. And then nuts and seeds are tremendously powerful, extending human life, protecting against both heart disease and cancer. And people aren't eating nuts and seeds and beans. We'll have to put beans in the salad, but nuts and seeds to make a salad dressing, like some tomato sauce with some almonds and sunflower seeds, maybe with some fig vinegar or balsamic vinegar in there with a few raisins, you know, mixed into the salad dressing. One of my favorite dressings is blend an orange with some cashews and sesame seeds. They even toast the sesame seeds with some blood orange vinegar or white wine vinegar. Tastes really great, too. But make a healthy salad and so on. So the first thing is the salad, the main dish.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing I want people to do is on the weekend make a giant pot of vegetable bean soup. Beans extend lifespan. Your vegetables cooked in the soup. And you water cook food. It prevents these acrylamides and dangerous compounds from being formed. The moisture prevents the drying and the over-baking and grilling foods that make it harmful. So we're talking about a big soup with beans and vegetables in it, maybe kale or mustard greens or turnips, you know, all kinds of carrot juice and vegetable broth base with onions and mushrooms. We're talking about delicious soup. And you make a giant pot and you can take it and have it for dinner with your lunch with a salad and a piece of fruit. It's so easy. It's not that hard to do this, because just think for a second. If you just did a salad and a soup and a piece of fruit for lunch, now, if you made your breakfast something simple like steel, like oats with some flax seeds and cherries or wild blueberries or some almond milk or something, made a healthy breakfast and a healthy lunch, that's three quarters. That's not two thirds. That's three quarters of the issue right there. We'd solve just from those two things. If people just did those two things, we'd solve half the health problems in America. Okay. And you know what I'm saying also is that we can make incredibly delicious desserts that kids love and people love that taste great. You know, without sugar, we can, like, for example, I love to eat ice cream, so I make two frozen bananas, a handful of macadamia nuts, and a nice teaspoon of vanilla bean powder blended up in a blender. It's so incredibly delicious. There's not even any dates or any even sugar in there. If I want to put a little cocoa powder in, unsweetened cocoa powder, and make it chocolatey, I can always put a date in there and sweeten it more. But the point I'm making now is that the effect of taking in sweets from fruit or from a little bit of dried fruit has a complete different biological effect. When you take sweets from honey, maple syrup, sugar, artificial sweeteners, agave nectars, and other forces of sugar that rush into the bloodstream much more rapidly. When the fruit makes it absorb into the bloodstream much more slowly, not having the negative effects on the body. So it's a different way of cooking and a different way of preparing food, and it can be made to taste delicious. And I'm trying, and this is just information that all Americans have to know about, and they got to learn about this, because it's such a negative effect on our society, what the way people are doing now.
Yeah, we can learn to enjoy eating healthy. As much as, in fact, you have a lot of recipe ideas and even some menus in the latter part of your book. And I mean, folks, I just opened it randomly. But listen to some of this. Raspberry dressing, healthy. Super simple hummus, healthy. Look at this. Walnut cream vinaigrette. He was talking about dressings a little earlier. Soups. Look at this. Corn and red pepper soup with sweet potatoes and the kale. So it's simply a matter of learning to enjoy. I mean, it's not a penance. It's not a hair shirt to eat healthy. You can learn to really like it.
You know, and that's right. And most of the people adopting this program who are starting to eat more or really healthier to prevent later life illnesses and to protect their brain, they report, and we did a study on this, published in this medical journal with more than 750 people, that they liked eating this way. They liked the taste as much or better than their old diet. And they didn't like it better right away. It took a few months for them to change their taste buds and learn the recipes. But once they adopted their taste buds and learned the new desserts and the new soups and all the things they could eat and their taste buds adjusted to it, they liked it just as much. So, you know, because I know some people listening are thinking to themselves, oh, yeah, I know I don't eat healthier. I know I could be healthier. But you know what? I'd rather just die. I'd rather live a shorter life and enjoy my life more and eat whatever I feel like it. And they're thinking that they're going to enjoy their life more. And they'd rather just live a shorter life. But they don't enjoy their life more. They enjoy their life less. And the food, us people who eat healthy, have just as much enjoyment with food as they do. But the difference is that the tragedies that ensue, they don't just die younger. Sometimes they suffer for decades in nursing homes or with diabetes or in pain or with suffering and with all kinds of medical tests and medical dependencies and their brain function decreases and their ability to be happy and it puts a fog over their mental thoughts and keeps them depressed and unable to think clearly. So we're talking here about food doesn't just make you die younger, it also lowers the quality of your life. So what I'm saying is that the effort to make these changes is worth it.
If we make a shift to a nutritarian, it's a word I hadn't seen until your book, by the way, nutritarian, nutrient-dense diet, can we expect to see a change? Will we feel a change? Will we see a change after a period of time?
Well, so many people have report that they think more clearly, the fog, and the cravings to overeat goes away. I mean, that's the thing. When you flood the body with nutrients, you're not craving calories. You're losing those addictions and desire to overeat. So people lose weight. They have more energy. They sleep better at night. Their sexual difficulties improve. You know, men's impotence problems go away. Their ability to perform at work and to concentrate. People do better in school and do better at work. And they're happier because they're not, you know, because depression is a major cause of eating poorly. It affects your brain, and even when you're not totally depressed, you're still a mild forms of emotional, you know, it affects you negative emotions even though you're not totally in a major depression. So people are much happier and you feel good about yourself, and now you can radiate, you can be a role model, and you can have a better effect on other people, and you can be happier, and you can live longer and maintain your mental faculties as you age and better quality of life. So the rewards are tremendous, including the financial rewards, how the medical expenses are destroying our economy and destroying people's individual wealth because everything they earn in life goes to pay for medical care as they get older.
I'm sure there are many listeners, Dr. Furman, right now are saying, well, this all makes sense, but look, I'm in my late 40s, I'm in my 50s, I'm in my 60s. Is it ever too late to shift over to the diet you're recommending?
Well, that's the whole point. That's one of the main points is that, you know, heart disease is reversible. Strokes are preventable. The number one cause of death in America is still heart attacks and strokes. And at almost any age, that can be prevented. You know, we can. So the point I'm making is that if you're alive, and a person listening to this broadcast is probably still alive, they can make changes to better the quality of their life and improve their health and reduce their body pain, their inflammation, their propensity for heart attacks and strokes, and their propensity for dementia. As long as they're still living, they could get in. They can improve their health. Of course, there's irreversible damage that can occur. Once you're demented and your brain shrinks, you can't grow back a new brain. So we do want people to start protecting their brain while they still have their full mental faculties intact. But even if you're starting to have memory loss and starting to get brain shrinkage, you're starting to be a little demented, like many Americans are because they're eating poorly, you want to stop the progression. You want to stop, you know, we can improve it a little bit, but we can't totally bring it back to normal if it gets too bad. The point is, now's the time to quit smoking. Now's the time to start eating right now. Don't delay. Now's the time to get off your junk food habit. Do it now before problems get worse.
Just a quick note to listeners about our guest, Dr. Joel Furman, M.D., is a board-certified family physician and nutritional researcher who specializes in preventing and reversing disease through nutritional and natural methods. Dr. Furman, do you have a website with more info or more information about your latest book, Fast Food Genocide?
Yes, my website is drfurman.com. That's, of course, drfurman.com. And certainly I'm very, very excited about this book. And this book, the launch day is today. This is the day this book comes out. So this is really exciting.
Excellent. Dr. Joel Furman, again, the title of the book, Fast Food Genocide, How Processed Food is Killing Us and What We Can Do About It. Just remember, Fast Food Genocide. You'll be able to find it. Thanks, Dr. Furman. Good to talk with you again. Thanks for being with us, sir.
Oh, thank you. My pleasure.
Sure. So long now. More to come on the It's Your Turn program. We're going to be talking about shifting your filters on the next segment of the program. That'll be in just a couple of minutes. Coming up tomorrow, our guests will include Dave Cord. He is the director of the Butler VA Medical Center. David Cord. We haven't talked with Mr. Cord since the opening of the A.B. Abraham, the new A.B. Abraham Community Healthcare Center out on Duffy Road. VA Director Dave Cord with us on tomorrow's program. We will also be talking tomorrow, among other guests, with Connie George, who is the Senior Director of Marketing and Community Relations with the Carnegie Science Center. That place is just fascinating, you know, Carnegie Science Center, and they're adding on to it now, too. I have to make a note to check with Connie George about that tomorrow. They've got new stuff coming up, and are they still going to have the miniature railroad village? I don't know. My guess is yes. I can remember. Have you seen it, Pat Parker? Have you seen it? I first saw it when the Science Center was still at the Buell Planetarium. You know, up in the Allegheny Center area, and it's been long gone from there for a long, long time. Connie George from the Carnegie Science Center will be visiting with us on tomorrow's program. So I hope that you can be with us as well. We have some other guests lined up for you as well on the Wednesday edition of It's Your Turn. One of our sponsors on the program today, our good friends at Cummings Candy and Coffee Shop. Three locations now. Of course, the flagship location is on North Main Street in downtown Butler. Been there for a century, actually more than a century. Cummings has been serving the Butler community since 1905, believe it or not. And they've been on North Main Street for about 100 years. All the peanut brittle is available right now. A lot of folks ask about that. You can pretty much tell when you walk in because the aroma of that fresh peanut brittle is something else. And it's not available all the time, but it is right now. Holidays are just around the corner. Cummings offers corporate orders of custom gift boxes to give to clients. I've done this. I've given their chocolate-covered potato chips, and they have been incredibly well-received by gift recipients. You can also choose from chocolate-covered pretzels, graham crackers, cherry cordials, and why not add a half-pound bag of Butler's own proprietary blend of coffee, the Main Street Roast from Cummings. You can't go wrong. Call Barry Cummings if you're interested in more info on corporate orders. 287-3287. 287-3287. And don't forget now, there's three locations of Cummings. Main Street, of course, North Main, right in the heart of downtown under the red and white awning. Also, there's a Cummings location at Butler Memorial Hospital and the newest location, Cummings West, on Route 68, Evans City Road, just outside of Butler. They're open 7 days a week. Cummings Candy and a Coffee Shop.
Midday lottery numbers for you today. The pick 2 is 1313. The pick 3 is 671. The pick 4, 0866. The pick 5, 73267. Wild ball for each of those is 8. And the treasure hunt, 9, 20, 22, 23, and 25. Estimated jackpot for tomorrow's treasure hunt, $10,000.
Going to be talking, listeners, about this is an interesting concept. It's a book written by Sarah Taylor. She's our guest. She joins us by telephone here on It's Your Turn on WISR. By the way, if you're just joining us, my name is Dave Malarkey. Sarah, the title of your book is Filter Shift. how effective people see the world. Can you tell us a little bit about this whole concept of filters? What exactly do you mean by that, Sarah?
Our filters, yes, Dave.
Yes.
Our filters operate in our unconscious, and they actually are our police, judge, and jury deciding for us on a moment-by-moment basis. And so, actually, they're in control. And I know that concept in and of itself might seem a little strange to folks. Folks will say, wait a second, I'm in control. I know what I'm thinking. I know what I'm deciding. But that's actually not the case. So we know from brain research that our unconscious is what drives our conscious. And in fact, Dave, a question that I ask folks a lot is, okay, tell me, what's your next thought going to be? And usually there's quite a bit of silence after that and some dumbfounded looks as folks think, well, wait a second, I can't tell you what my next thought will be. And what that brain research tells us is we don't know what the next thought will be because our unconscious is deciding that for us. Our unconscious taking in exponentially more information and deciding what our conscious mind has access to. And it's our filters that are really determining that. So filter shift is about getting a sense of what's going on with those unconscious filters and starting to take control back from them in order to be our most effective in all of our interactions.
How do we develop these filters? I assume they're something that develops as we go through life.
They are, yeah. They're developed by our past experiences, and they get stored there. And a moment-by-moment basis, we're adding to our filters. But since they come from our past experiences, and I don't know of anyone that shares all of the exact same past experiences with anyone, that means that we don't share the same filters. And if our filters are deciding what I think, that means that they're not deciding the same as others are deciding. So once again, it points to the fact that I got to get a good sense of what's going on with my filters.
So this would be important from a standpoint of interpersonal communication, certainly yeah. From a standpoint of diversity. I mean, I'm just trying to pick out a hypothetical example here. If you're walking down the street and you see a person of color approaching you from the other direction, or perhaps a woman in a burqa, then depending on your experiences mm-hmm. in life, you would have certain filters that automatically kick in.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It does really impact in our interactions across difference, which if you actually think about it, that's every interaction. But yeah, as you point out, some of those very obvious differences, and the really, I think, interesting piece about that is I may not have ever had, to your example, an experience with a woman who's wearing a burqa, but yet if you just said that, you know, as you said that and people thought about that, they got an image in their mind. And they also had a whole bunch of thoughts come to their mind about that person. But yet, like for me, I had lots of thoughts that came to my mind when you said a woman with a burqa. But how many actual experiences have I had with someone, a woman with a burqa? Not too many, but yet I still have all of those filters.
Now, you had an example that struck me in the beginning of your book. Listeners, we're talking with Sarah Taylor. She's the author of Filter Shift, How Effective People See the World. It was an example, a quick story of former Governor Bill Richardson, who had been sent on a mission to the Middle East. Saddam Hussein was still in power in Iraq, and he'd been sent there by President Clinton to have a meeting with him, and he went into one of his palaces, and with all good intentions, Bill Richardson sat down, wanted to appear comfortable and informal, crossed one leg over the other, and immediately Saddam Hussein pounded the table, got up, and ran out of the room, slammed the door. Richardson didn't know what the heck was going on.
That's right.
Wrong filter.
That's right. That's right. Wrong filter. And, you know, if you think about that, whoa, wait a second. Bill Richardson, very, very successful person. He has run businesses. He's been a government leader. And in that particular situation, he had 3 months to prepare for that meeting with 3 staff members. But yet, because his filters were in control, he, as you said, Saddam Hussein was slamming his hand on the table seconds after the meeting started and walking out of the room. And it was because, as he was really trying to be informal, he showed the sole of his shoe as he sat back in his chair and crossed his legs. That, a very offensive gesture. It'd be the same, essentially, as Saddam Hussein sending an emissary to, who was president at the time, President Clinton, sending an Iraqi emissary to the Oval Office, and that person walking into the Oval Office to meet with President Clinton and essentially flipping them off. Hmm. That's essentially what Bill Richardson did, and he did it not because he wanted to be rude. Obviously, he wanted to be his best. He wanted to be his most effective, but he did it because his filters were in control.
Well, let's talk a little bit about how we change our filters, how we readjust, how we refocus.
Yeah, exactly. That's really the end step. But where we have to start is just acknowledging our own filters. I need to understand what my unconscious is telling me and the patterns of my filters so that I can see how those filters are making decisions and in control for me. Then the next step is I need to see the filters of others. And I can't get into their unconscious, but I can get a sense of them through their external behaviors. And then finally, I actually shift my filters in order to take on a different approach and to be more effective.
This book, by the way, listeners, it's not a real heavy read. It's only about 100 pages, but Sarah has a number of examples that she, real life examples that she talks about, similar to the Bill Richardson story. One thing I think that is critical, many of us would think that applying the golden rule would be effective if we want to. Okay, I want to make sure I do the right thing. The golden rule: do unto others as I would have others do unto me. But you say, for goodness sakes, that's not very effective at all, and sometimes can be the wrong thing. What's the deal on that, Sarah?
Yeah, and doesn't that seem strange? Because you know the golden rule is fabulous. It teaches us just a base of we need to be respectful with one another. But if you think about the golden rule, do unto others as I would have them do unto me, it's based on just a teeny tiny assumption, and that is that the whole world wants to be treated the way I want to be treated. And that's just not the case. And what is actually deciding how I want to be treated is my filters. So, again, since I don't share the same filters with anyone in the world, I can't honestly say that how I want to be treated is how they want to be treated. So I move to that rule. How do others want to be treated? I treat them the way they want to be treated, and that's the platinum rule. But the only way I can do that is if I'm able to filter shift.
Listeners, Filter Shift, Sarah's book specifically outlines the steps, 3 of them, needed to bring those unconscious decisions to the conscious mind, and a bunch of real life stories and anecdotes. Sarah Taylor is the president and founder of Deep Sea Consulting. She's a nationally recognized speaker and consultant specializing in the areas of leadership, diversity, and organizational effectiveness. And she has been our guest for the last few minutes. Sarah Taylor, author of Filter Shift. Thank you, Sarah. Nice to talk with you today.
Thanks so much, Dave. Thanks for having me.
Sure. So long now. Hearing aid service by Kelly. Have you heard about Kelly? She's called the hearing aid lady. And folks, I want to tell you, if you've reached a stage in life where you realize you may need some help in hearing effectively, I suggest you give her a call. Personalized one-on-one care. Your hearing aid will be measured to fit your ear, and Kelly will take the time to make sure that everything is just the way you want it. Not only from a hearing standpoint, obviously, but comfort too. A lot of folks get a hearing aid or get a new hearing aid and they don't wear it a lot because it hurts. It's not comfortable. You will not have that problem. if you're dealing with a hearing aid service by Kelly. She's interested in helping you, not in selling you the highest priced hearing aid. In fact, you'll save thousands because there's no overhead. Thousands, true. Complimentary consultation. So many people who have made the change or even just consulted with Kelly are so very happy that they did so. Call her. Talk to her. The Hearing Aid Lady. Phone number 724-756-4327. Hearing Aid Service by Kelly. K-E-L-L-I-E. Here's the phone number again. 724-756-4327. I guess that about wraps up our program for today. Coming up on tomorrow's program, David Cord, Director of VA Butler Healthcare. Also coming